Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Vow, on faculty with the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center of Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, good to see you. Very dapper in your glasses.
Hey, what do you think of my new glasses?
These are
my reading glasses.
So, welcome to the fold.
That's right. Yeah, yours are a little similar, aren't they?
We have jackets and an initiation.
I haven't learned the handshake yet.
No, not yet.
No. I guess as the director, I ought to dictate the handshake, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Now that I think about it. Good to see you. We had a great little conversation yesterday or Sunday night around the table. As many of you know, the listeners know, we have a Sunday night dinner that's open to anybody that would like to come, basically, that has its goal of having an honest conversation about whatever question comes up from the table.
Right. So, inspired by like the LaBrie model.
Right. The idea of having a conversation around the table. And then the questions come from the people themselves, the people who are there. So we say we can talk about anything. We can talk about anything. And one guy was reading about a conference that's coming up in July in St. Louis.
Yes.
That is being sponsored by a PCA church. And I think some members of the faculty at the PCA Seminary in St. Louis are also in support of it. I have to check on that, but I believe that's what the website said.
Right, and it's been sponsored by some big evangelical names like Francis Chan and Matthew Chandler, without Ch in their last name.
Right. And it's called the Revoice Conference.
Right, Revoice.
Revoice Conference. And it's about the question of how the church might engage with the homosexual community, mm-hmm. and I guess they would say LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But for purposes of our conversation, I may just sort of shorten that to gay community and meaning all of those things.
Sure.
Our intentions are not to insult anybody by leaving them out, but it's just too many syllables for me to keep track of.
Right.
So I may just shorten it to that, but for our purposes here.
Sure.
Anyway, it sounds like it's a very interesting conference. Uh-huh. And you and I have both now taken a look at the websites and even some of the responses to the websites.
Yeah.
And there are a few questions that have come up in the Christian community, and certainly there were questions around the table on Sunday night. How did you find the conversation? Did you want to lay out how it went?
Sure. I mean, well, the person who brought it up had seen it and had like read an article against it, and then an article by the pastor of the church that's hosting it responding to against it. And it was an interesting discussion because the question on the table was not very much about the Revoice Conference, because not everybody at the table had read about the Revoice Conference.
Right. It just raised some other questions.
Yeah, it raised some other questions, mainly about, well, how do we engage the LGBT community? We can use that term. How do we engage them? Because it seems pretty apparent that the millennial generation, especially, aside from like maybe statistically, there's a lot of them that are more okay with it, with like homosexual behavior or even transgender behavior, maybe. Despite from that, there's still the fact that even if you're like hold a traditional Christian biblical sexual ethic, you're going to grow up into, or you're going to step out into a world where that type of behavior, at least for the time being, is normalized and is sort of normalized to be accepted. And how exactly you engage with that is a big question, especially if you like feel like whether you feel like you're just going to have like a normal job and an average life, or if you feel like you've been called to address the culture in some specific way, you're going to run into this.
Yeah.
And how exactly to address it. It feels like sort of a fire and brimstone leading with your chin kind of way of doing it. Doesn't seem very adequate. But then capitulating and compromising doesn't seem adequate either, or even right.
Yeah.
Neither one of those ways seem to be right. And so there's this issue of like, well, how do we navigate this? It can be frustrating because in one sense, homosexual behavior is, if I could put it this way, not take it lightly, but if I could put it this way, it's just another sexual sin. I mean, it's like all sexual sins are wrong.
Right.
And why does this one have to be so particularly pointed out? Like, you know, it's some reason it just feels like it's just another sexual sin. On the other hand, as one of the people at the table said, like, you know, we don't have a conference trying to create dialogue with adulterers.
Yeah.
So why are we doing this with this? Well, I suppose one answer to that would be that, well, adulterers haven't formed a community with, like, political power and cultural voice and are trying to change legislation and stuff.
Right.
It's not something you actually have to, like, directly engage in the public square. Privately, it may not be no different. You may still have to engage an adult, someone who's committed adultery, with the same sort of grace and truth that you would with somebody who's, like, engaged in homosexual behavior. But the LGBT community is an actual thing that has, like, cultural presence and capital. And so how to engage with it is a question that bugs a lot of people, especially millennials, and me too. Like, that it bugs me too. I feel like how exactly do you engage with this if you hold to the traditional sexual ethic of sex is intended for marriage between a man and a woman, for procreation, to mirror Christ and his church, and even ultimately God as a Trinitarian unity.
Right. Amen. Like, amen. That's all.
How do you do that?
Yeah. Maybe what would be good is if we quote their website a little bit and get into the sort of theological questions that have to arise about what is sin and what isn't, you know, and like that. Have you got it in front of you? Do you have the mission statement that they gave?
Yeah, I had a bunch of that. They have a website. I think it's like Revoice.org.
.us. I think it's
Revoice.us.
That's right.
Maybe they're doing conferences elsewhere. So they have a mission statement, which I abhor mission statements.
But, you don't like mission statements.
No, I'll get to why in a second. But they have a mission statement, and they have a vision statement, which is a bigger thing. And the mission statement says, to encourage, support, and empower gay, lesbian, and other same-sex-attracted Christians so they can experience the life-giving character of the historic Christian sexual ethic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before you have to, like, parsing out or pointing out things. Having read the website stuff, and also the Revoice Conference is sponsored not by the church it's going to, but by something called the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender.
Okay.
Whose president is our old friend Preston Sprinkle, who we talked about the Nashville statement.
From the Nashville statement
a few podcasts back. That may have been, I think it was earlier
it
this
year.
It was
number three or two or four
it was
or
last
something.
Year. Okay, it was
right. Yeah, last fall.
So, having looked at, like, the center's site, the Center for Faith, Sexual, and Gender site,
right.
And Revoice's site, what I get is this. I get that this is a conference for Christians who, on the whole, it seems, maybe they're allowing elbow room for disagreement, but on the whole, it's for Christians, whether they be straight, non-straight, or whatever, who agree with and want to adhere to the historic Christian sexual ethic.
It's
people who have same-sex attraction or whatever, but they recognize that that's not biblical, that's not the way God wants sex to go, so I want to live my life according to the Christian sexual ethic. Like, that's the whole point.
Right, right. And everything we've seen has shown an adherence to that Orthodox Christian sexual definition of marriage and sexuality. Don't you agree?
Yeah, like in the vision statement. Let me read the vision statement, which is a bit larger. I'm not sure if I care for vision statements more than mission statements, but let's go with this. Revoice exists because we want to see LGBT people who adhere to the historic Christian sexual ethic.
Yeah,
so that's like
go.
That's the qualification. It's like it's not just LGBT people, but those who adhere to the historic Christian sexual ethic flourish in their local faith communities. In other words, it's like they're there. There are Christians who have same-sex attraction, or I think they even say gender dysphoria on in the vision.
Uh-huh.
They have these things, but they recognize that this is not God's plan for sexuality, so they want to adhere to God's plan. But the church's general track record, individual churches, your mileage may vary, but its general track record has not been extremely warm or welcome to someone who finds himself in the church. And they have same-sex attraction, and either they don't know what to do, or they have same-sex attraction, and they agree that it's wrong, but they're scared to come out, and they don't know what to do. They fear rejection and not welcome, and even if they don't get exactly rejection, they'll feel like a pariah in their own church. And the Revoice seems to be trying to address that.
Is that? Do you think that then what they're trying to do is, maybe I'm putting it in other words, address the concern that the church actually hasn't been very embracing of people who are suffering from these kinds of problems. Okay. Well, because so they're recognizing these things, like you say, as dysphoria or as proper sexual attraction, mm-hmm. but they are also seeing that people aren't very warm or embracing of people who are struggling with those things.
Yeah.
Is that kind
of... that sounds like it. I mean,
okay, I think it's good for us, as always, to go through things like this and see where we agree before we disagree. And I think one of the big things we seem to agree with them about is this understanding of the biblical sexual biblical definitions for sexuality and marriage. That's good, because if they're weak on that and then they start using all these other terms that we're going to talk about, I'd love to unpack some of those other terms. Then it can be very confusing.
Yeah. So we see the rest of the vision statement. We envision, here we go,
okay,
a future Christianity where LGBT people can be open and transparent in their faith communities about their orientation and or experience of gender dysphoria, without feeling inferior to their straight, cisgendered brothers and sisters, where churches not only utilize but also celebrate the unique opportunities that lifelong celibate LGBT people have to serve others. Because that's like the one of the things on the Revoice thing is that there's only like, it's like marriage or celibacy. Those are the only two proper sort of contexts for human sexuality. It's like
right.
either you're married or you're devoted entirely to God.
Right.
And that's it.
Right.
Where Christian leaders boast about the faith of LGBT people who are living a sacrificially obedient life for the sake of the kingdom,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. where LGBT people are welcomed into family so they too can experience the joys, challenges, and benefits of kinship. So that last one, like welcomed into families, I don't. A little vague, but maybe it just means like church families. But
uh-huh.
it's this sense of like Christians who hold to the traditional sexual ethic found in Scripture. He had a same-sex attracted. Here's a place to like begin establishing where they can come out in a different way. Like they can come out as, I have these attractions, but I adhere to the sexual ethic. You know, my church community, please help me and be with me on this. And the church community will be like, absolutely. And we'll like mm-hmm. come up around. Mm-hmm. So like trying to lay groundwork for that.
Yeah.
Because again,
yeah.
the assumption is that, and it's not a misplaced assumption necessarily, the assumption that the church in general has not really done that
mm-hmm.
very well.
I see. That's the implication anyway, I think. And maybe they come right out and say it.
Mm-hmm.
The church ought to be addressing anybody that way, right? I mean, anybody who is saying, I have repented of my sin and I am struggling to stand in faith and walk with God in that area of my life, would you come and surround me with love and help me, you know, be a part of my life and let me be a part of yours?
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. If you didn't say that, then there wouldn't be anybody in the church.
Yeah, yes. I think now when I look at these things, let's discuss. Okay, so there's like, of course, this raised a lot of brouhaha.
I bet.
All right.
Well, it did it around the table too, didn't it?
It did around the table.
I think in general, but even around our table.
Even around the table.
Yeah. There's a lot of good questions.
There's a lot of good questions. The brouhaha around, like, at the table and out in the, you know, out on the interwebs, as it were, basically revolved around. Is this conference, intentionally or not, kind of nudging the door open to allow for a capitulation on the question of, like, LGBT sexual behavior?
Uh-huh.
Like, is this thing, even the most generous reading of it would be, even if this thing, we agree with it, is trying to establish, you know, a better relationship and a better sort of approach and attitude of Christians towards, like, you know, same-sex attracted people who want to, like, adhere to whatever, the thing we just said. Mm-hmm. Even if that's what it's intentionally doing, is it not possible that the way it's doing it is going to kind of open the door a bit to allow for eventually complete capitulation on the sexual
ethic? Uh-huh.
Like, there are already, like, Christians who lean leftward on, like, theological and political issues who already say that the Bible just either doesn't condemn homosexual behavior, or it does, but those parts are outmoded and outdated, and it's part of our job to recognize that.
That was one of the questions I think that was going to be addressed in a workshop there at this conference in July.
Yeah. And so I went around looking for, like, responses to it. I know the pastor who is hosting the church, who is the pastor of the church that's hosting the conference,
yeah,
responded to a lot of it by saying that this is about upholding the traditional Christian sexual ethic and about people with same-sex attraction who adhere to it and want help and, like, you know, community with it. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
I went out and looked for, like, responses or, like, things who are against it. One place I visit that I used to visit a long time ago was a blog called Pyromaniacs, which they are a bit more curmudgeonly in the Reformed tradition than most, but definitely more curmudgeonly than I would deport myself. But they're usually intelligent, articulate, and scriptural.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to read them like years ago because they engaged with something called the emergent church, which was like
right.
Christianity sort of flirting around with the not so good elements of postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
And they dealt
mm-hmm.
with that. And eventually it just sort of that the emergent church kind of died or whatever. And one of their main bloggers disappeared after that because he's like, well, I'm going to go focus on other things because the emergent church is gone. Well, he announced like a week ago today or something like that, that he was coming back. And it was because there were other sort of ways the Christian evangelical church was flirting with like postmodern-y kind of values and worldly values.
This is Phil Johnson.
Yeah, Phil Johnson. He came back out of retirement from it saying that there were other ways that the evangelical church was trying to capitulate to culture. And one of his first blog posts was on the Revoice Conference.
Uh-huh.
And his contentions, I think there were several, but one of his main contentions is that it seemed like this conference was allowing for the idea that same-sex attraction is okay and that that's fine. In other words, he felt like there was not enough repentance language or like
uh-huh.
telling LGBT people with homosexual behavior that that behavior or that attraction even itself, that desire is itself sinful and needs to be repented and mortified of. This is poorly paraphrasing him, so if Phil Johnson ever listens to something like this, I don't know why he would, but I apologize, Phil, for butchering your words. But it was basically something like, it felt like it was being way too soft on the issue of homosexual behavior. And that in being too soft on it, it was kind of opening the door for allowing a sort of eventual capitulation. There was another guy I read who he connected to that made it sound like the Revoice Conference just was a flat-out capitulation. Like it just...
Altogether.
Wow. It just accepted with open arms homosexual behavior as non-sinful or something like that, which is incorrect.
Yeah, that doesn't seem quite fair to
Yeah, that's
just.
Not fair. If you look at what
based
that
on
say,
what I've seen them saying, yeah. But, we can have questions about it. I think we could talk about some of it, but I'm not willing to just say that there's nothing there that I disagree with.
No.
But I think to dismiss the whole thing seems to me to be undiscerning.
From my own perspective, I'm gathering like two problems that are happening at the Revoice
Yeah,
conference.
Okay. What do you think?
And maybe two problems that even we're like kind of having with it. The first one we could address, and we could do this looking at the mission statement stuff, and I'll get into why I don't like mission statements, is one of my first... This was from just looking at the Revoice's website and going over it and seeing what it was saying. I feel like they're a victim of their own marketing because a lot of what they put on that website, you know, in their mission statement, their vision statement, the titles and blurbs for their workshops and so on
yeah,
and so forth,
yeah.
All of it is soaked in a kind of contemporary academic and business speak that
uh-huh.
is not good. It's not really good to use, I could argue, in any situation, but it's definitely not good to use when you're trying to address something that's going to be kind of necessarily controversial. Because,
mm-hmm.
like, okay, so like the academic-y jargon, like they use things, they use terms like intersectionality.
Yes.
And there are other things littered throughout there that the people who used them seemed to assume that these terms were just sort of accepted and normal and okay, and it didn't seem to occur to them that those terms bode different things
yes.
for different people depending
yes.
on where they are politically. Because intersectionality as a term gets used by certain, you know, radical leftism to actually inflame identity politics in
right.
some way.
Right.
So the academic-y speak wasn't very helpful, but the big one, and this is actually the bigger part of it, was the business speak. All right.
Mm-hmm.
In the mission statement, this is why I hate mission statements, because they are just the par excellence example of business speak. Business speak is where you take what you're doing and you either just you're trying to distill it down, or in the best case you're distilling it. In the worst case, you're trying to
spin it in a certain direction.
Yeah, you generalize it and make it really vague, but spin it in a positive manner.
Right. What is it in the mission statement that you saw here that sounds like business speak to you?
Well, I could say this is what I'm going
to
say.
You read it to us once, but
yeah,
give us a shot.
I said it could be
that.
Like a victim of their own marketing is right here in the mission statement. To encourage, support, and empower gay, lesbian, and other same-sex attracted Christian. Okay, stop. What do you mean by empower?
Right.
Right. I mean, one of the big beefs seemed to be over terminology. And then the pastor who's hosting the church, in like a response essay, he had all the criticism. He basically took to task the issue over terminology. It seemed like people were mad about the terminology he was using. And his basic rejoinder was that, look, we use the terminology we use because we had to use something, but the terminology is not the point. The point is getting them in there and having these discussions, stuff like that.
That makes me nervous because the terminology really does matter. And we here at the center kind of nitpicky about terms and about definitions for everything. You can't have a decent discussion about something if you don't agree on the definitions of the terms to begin with.
Yeah.
When somebody uses the word to empower. There's a kind of implication about where the power comes from.
Right.
And I think if what they're saying here, for example, is, as you just said, that is the power of the gospel to order our hearts and minds, to clarify for us, you know, what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
The power of the gospel to forgive us. You know, those kinds of powers, it's all coming from God. It's all coming from the word that he's spoken. Then more power to him. That is the power that I'm interested in, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of times what these conferences are talking about when they say empower is an empowerment that comes from a certain agreeableness of the people there. So that if there's a problem between, say, those who are same-sex attracted, feeling like they're not accepted by the church, and if that's what the conference really is all about, then they're trying to empower the people to be heard by the church, or they're empowering Christians to learn how to embrace and accept their fallen brothers and sisters. Then it seems to me that it's a horizontal power then that they're trying to do, and that's very dicey, I think.
Yeah, it's like empower is, I think before we started the podcast, you said there's a lot of buzzwords all throughout the thing.
Right, that's what I found in it.
That's the problem I have with the terminology. Like empower, okay, like empower them, and in their vision statement they unpack maybe what they mean by empower. But in the mission statement, which again is why I hate mission statements, empower is kind of a pop culture, pop philosophy, pop psychology. The pop culture, pop philosophy, pop psychology usage of it means like complete and total affirmation and agreement.
Right.
With like what they're doing.
Right.
That's the only way you can empower someone is to not stand in the way of their self-realization.
Yes.
I don't think that's what they mean here. But they seem to lead with just this blanket statement about encourage, support, and empower. And it's like, okay, well, what do you mean by encouraging, supporting, empowering? Do you mean affirming a lifestyle? Do you mean capitulation and compromise? Or do you mean this in a specific gospel-y way? The back end of the statement does say the life-giving character of the historic Christian sexual ethic.
Right. But and that's helpful.
That's helpful. But when you lead with the empowering thing, it does lead, it can make some people who care about that historic Christian sexual ethic raise their eyebrows about what exactly are you trying to do.
Yeah.
The other part of it that people took issue with was the second part of that sentence, to encourage, support, and empower. Then the other part of it, gay, lesbian, other same-sex attracted Christians.
Right.
And their question was, what do you mean by same-sex attracted Christian?
Right.
Because that term gets used by typically people on more left-leaning theologically and politically to mean people who see themselves as fully faithful Christians and they fully indulge in their same-sex attraction, the LGBT sexual behavior, and they don't see any disjointment from that because, of course, God affirms my sexuality.
God made me this way, so I can be Christian and I can practice my homosexual lifestyle simultaneously.
Right, and it seems, again, what they mean by same-sex attracted Christian is that it's Christians who struggle with this particular temptation.
Right.
That's what it means.
Right.
Now, if that's what they mean, so the empower one, get a little concerned about that, but it's arguable that that one's nitpicky and like that the vision statement kind of clarifies. But the one about a gay Christian or a lesbian Christian or a same-sex attracted Christian or LGBT Christian, that one seems to have the bigger purchase or bigger worry because it's this idea of like, It's like why I think you said earlier before the podcast, why do we have to attach anything extra to Christian?
Right.
Like at all. Doesn't it seem like you're at, like, we don't say like adulterer Christians.
Right.
You know, if we really believe homosexual behavior is sin, then take same-sex, and we think same-sex attraction is some kind of, or at least same-sex attraction is some sort of disordered desire, then just replace that with any other disordered desire, like a desire to steal or a desire to lie or a desire to whatever, and say, like, well, I'm a lying attracted Christian.
Right.
You know, or I'm a fear attracted Christian. You know, or
anxiety attracted
Christian. Or a distrust attracted Christian or gossip attracted Christian. And it's like, it seems kind of absurd. Like, why would you have, because the word Christian suggests something about identity, and it's the identity thing that bugs people and makes this actually such a big bugbear.
Well, I think you're hitting on where it is that I have concerns too. I do agree that most of the the definition of sexuality and marriage is orthodox in their minds. They're not willing to compromise on that. But then the question comes up, there are two questions. One is about the terminology, and is it possible that through the use of terminology, we are tacitly embracing certain assumptions right. about sexuality or about how we should relate to sin? Right. And that I'd like to explore.
By the terminology, are we not giving footholds and certain purchase for
That's
things
right.
we don't want.
To things we actually don't agree with.
Right.
And secondly, the question of where the sin actually stands in this particular area.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of debate about whether or not same-sex attraction is itself the sin or whether it's only the indulgence of that through action that's
right.
the sin. And I think if you want to start with that, well, we've been talking about the verbiage. Let's stick with the verbiage for a while, but I'd like to get to that second
one,
too.
I think that's at the heart of it.
The verbiage question, it seems to me, is much more subtle than even the sort of buzzwords like empowerment or even intersectionality, although that has so many implications. I think that would be a good one for them to have to define.
Yeah.
But even the word community starts to concern me, because if you start talking about something called the gay community, mm-hmm. what do we mean by that? Mm-hmm. Is there a group? Are we talking about a group of people who have community? Are they of one mind about things? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. We see divisions already between those who say I'm same-sex attracted but I'm sticking to celibacy, mm-hmm. and others who say I'm same-sex attracted but I believe I can indulge my
right.
my same-sex.
There's even a division between like older homosexuals who fought tooth and nail to argue that their attraction was biologically determinate. That is
right.
like they're born this way. They're like this. They don't have a choice. It's just the way that they are. There's an argument between them and younger ones who buy into the gender attraction spectrum that somehow it isn't tied down to biology.
Exactly.
At all.
That's very confusing people, too.
That's
in fact,
another
they're
going to
find some real contradictions, I think, there, because in fact, that's one of the questions I've got, even with the term LGBTQ. Mm. Can you say that the T stands for something that we can go along with?
Yeah.
Does
the T stand for something even a lesbian or a
exactly.
person would go along with.
Right. There are statements, I think, within the material we've been reading where they talk about same-sex attracted people, and I can see that for L and for G, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The T question is really the younger question you were just talking about, where if there isn't any difference, or if gender is completely fluid, then it would be very difficult to even understand L and G.
Yeah.
And much less the whole transgender thing where a person is in a man's body but thinks he's a female, or the reverse. If there isn't any difference between the two, how would you ever know that you were a man in a woman's body or vice versa? There's a whole lot of conflict there. And it seems to me to allow that whole lot of conflict to be considered a community almost gives sin a position that it shouldn't have. What I would prefer is that we define, like they have, what a good orthodox biblical picture is of sexuality, and that everybody is broken, since we're all sinners. Mm-hmm. We're all broken in some way sexually. Mm-hmm. It may be in our attractions. It may be in our heterosexual attractions. Maybe we're too easily swayed by, you know, your secretary or something, you know, somebody that you meet, you know, at work that's of the opposite gender, mm-hmm. sex or gender. I'm going to use those interchangeably. But to sort of simplify matters to one particular group seems to me to give that particular kind of sin a foothold, like we were saying, a purchase from which they can argue a special kind of suffering, a special kind of difficulty. I mean, you hear I'll give you an example that came up at the dinner table the other night. One of the girls was saying, to ask a homosexually attracted person to give up the possibility of ever fulfilling that sexually, mm-hmm. is to ask something of him that you're not asking of the heterosexually challenged person. Because there is such a thing as heterosexual marriage, where we're saying there isn't such a thing as homosexual marriage. In other words, there's no place for that desire.
There's no outlet.
There's no outlet for that desire. Exactly. And so aren't we asking something very, even if we have to ask it of them, don't we need to be very, you know, sympathetic and concerned that that's something that they're going to have to live with their whole lives? Mm-hmm. Well, and I thought, well, yeah, but yes. Yeah, I mean, shouldn't we all, in a sense, have sympathy for the person who's going through the struggle of trying to get out of sin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The compassion.
I think the problem, there is this tradition. I've heard this from more Catholic people, like the bad Catholic dude, Mark Barnes, I mentioned.
Oh, right. Yes.
I mean, he argues from this position that the actual response to people who say like that, well, aren't you denying them an outlet for that energy? His response is, no, you're not. Like, devotion to God is the outlet for that energy.
Uh-huh.
And,
uh-huh.
like, devotion to God and, like, devotion to the energies of friendship is, like, part of it. There was something I read that, like, argued that friendship is actually more important than even sexual intimacy.
That's another point that I tried to bring up the other night. That's right. Let me pick on a couple of things have gone on came up that night that might be of interest to people. Mm-hmm. First of all, that idea that you just mentioned, that it may very well be that what we think of as homosexual attraction is a kind of perversion of friendship. I'm not trying to deny anybody the reality of their experiences, but I'm thinking it's not so much that I'm putting down the homosexual attraction experience. I'm raising the definition of friendship up to such a high level. If we understood friendship properly, we would realize that friends really are very close.
Yeah.
And a betrayal or a desire that breaks that friendship, some kind of problem that breaks that friendship, is extremely painful.
Yes.
For people. And it's because friendship is a huge part of what it means to be a human being. And sadly, because we have hypersexualized our culture, we assume that any strong emotions between two people must be a kind of sexual attraction.
Frodo and Sam must. Obviously
they must be homosexual, exactly.
Jonathan and David.
That's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. That you see obvious friendships in the world, and you probably have experienced some of them. We all have experienced some of them. If we haven't, then we're missing out, because friendship really is a profound thing. In fact, I think, I've been trying to say this to young people, that you ought to be very close friends with your spouse, too.
Yes.
That even your spouse ought to be somebody where you have a lot of things in common. C.S. Lewis talked at length about what friendship was in the great book, The Four Loves, and he talks about how friendship is two people standing side by side looking at the same thing, whatever it is, baseball, stamp collecting, God.
Yeah.
And loving it so much that they enjoy each other's company,
right?
Because of that thing they enjoy together. That's what friendship is. And that eros, romantic love, sexual love, is two people who stand facing each other.
Yeah.
And the two people who stand facing each other want to be alone.
Yeah.
But the two friends are fascinated by what they're looking at, and they want to include other people in their group that loves the same thing. They were always happy to have a third, you know, come and join them. And the confusion comes in that question of whether you're looking at the thing together and enjoying each other's company, or whether you're looking at each other. And any kind of strong emotional attachment between two people that can come from sharing life together could turn into this idea of eros, of romantic love, you see. And the confusion there, I think, may be at the source of some of the homosexual problem.
I just see, like, in the Frodo Sam thing or the David and Jonathan thing, there is this sort of tendency to, especially amongst men for some reason, like when it's two guys, there's some weird reason that, well, if two guys are that close, it must be sexual.
Exactly.
It's the same principle that, well, if you're really that close with someone, there must be sexual tension there. Maybe this is Freud's fault, I don't know. But there's this sense of, like, everything's reduced. All fundamental desire is fundamentally sexual.
Right, exactly.
And so there is no such thing.
Yeah, that's a mistake.
I think, yeah, there is no such thing as a non-sexual desire. And it's, I remember the stupidity of it that frustrated me the most. Or, like, the stupidity of it really frustrated me, like, I think late last year or maybe a while ago, where there was a momentary trend. Maybe it's still a trend on Tumblr, I don't know. But there was a momentary trend where people were arguing after Civil War happened, the movie Civil War, not the Civil War. Tumblr was not around back then. But after the Marvel
really?
Movie Civil War happened, where, like, one of the central plot is, like, Captain America trying to save his friend Bucky from, like, being accused of these things and being hunted down and stuff like that. There was a trend that came out that said, you know, that was like hashtag give Cap a girl boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted it to be Bucky because they're like, oh, it's so obvious. They're so close together. And why can't they obvious? They have this deep. Why can't they be, like, in a relationship? Obviously
mm-hmm.
something's there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just about wanted to, like, when they did, like, with Frozen, and they say, like, you know, give give Elsa a girlfriend. I mean, that, again, I'm like, yeah, but logically I can understand it because of the way that the movie portrayed her.
Uh-huh.
There's an open possibility that that would be what she would do. But with this one, it so infuriated me. I, like, wrote back and I made, like, my own hashtag where I said, guys can have besties too.
Ah, yeah.
All right.
Very good.
It was this weird. So what is, like, why is it that guys are not allowed to have a deep friendship without it, everybody assuming it's sexual? Why can't it just...
Right.
But then you could apply that. Why can't it be that a guy and a girl can have a deep friendship
that's
not sexual at all? It's just a deep friendship. Why can't a girl and a girl? I think there is something screwy in the whole... And I think the LGBT movement in general has ingested this, whether they know it or not, that somehow sexuality is fundamental to who you are and what you do.
Right. Right,
and that's all actions can be deemed that way.
That's a good point, and that kind of cuts back to the point we were trying to make about earlier about how if we are asking a homosexually attracted person to give up the possibility of fulfillment, you know, consummation of that homosexual desire, we're asking something of great import and huge weight because it's going against his
fundamental whatever.
Yeah, for the rest of his life, he's going to have to suffer with this unfulfilled tension. But the reality is that our sexual preferences, our sexual desires, come and go a little bit. I mean, I don't mean to say that that all people are sometimes homosexual attracted. That's not what I mean. I just mean that even within marriage, there's a kind of up and down cycle to things, you know. Sometimes you feel very sexually attracted to one another. Sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
But the marriage, the beauty of the marriage is that you're committed to something much larger than just your feelings, momentary feelings, and they come and go a little bit. Well, in the same way, I think you find that there are stories, they may not be publicized very well, but there are plenty of stories that I've read about people who were indulging in a homosexual lifestyle, who came to Christian understanding and faith and turned around and eventually got married and had a family and felt very, very good in that. I'm not saying that there's not a tension there still.
They didn't pray the gay away.
I'm not saying that you can suddenly sort of snap a finger. Like, But I mean, there are people that have turned that corner in a sense, and lived a life that was very fulfilling sexually to them, even though they may have had these attractions early on. In the same way, not everybody who becomes a Christian suddenly, you know, can give up smoking,
right,
or give up drugs, or give up any other path that is difficult for them to give up. But some people do, too. I mean, yeah. I think my wife actually was one who smoked when she was a teenager in college or whatever. And when she became a Christian, bang, she just didn't have any interest in it anymore, and she stopped. It was
right.
just overnight. Well, that doesn't happen with everybody.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not arguing that it happens with homosexual attraction. But I am arguing that it's a because of the fact that it goes up and down, and because of the fact that people have different experiences with it, and that these things are temporary in their intensity, if not their completeness,
mm-hmm.
That means that it's an all the more ephemeral hook to attach your identity to.
Yeah.
You see, it's very dangerous. That's why I said earlier on, before the podcast, why do we want to put modifiers before the word Christian?
Yeah.
You know, I'm an LGBTQ Christian, right? Or I'm a recovering alcoholic Christian. Why do I want to put that there?
Right. I'm a conservative Christian.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I'm a conservative. I'm a liberal Christian. You don't want to attach your identity, because Christian is your identity.
Yeah.
But you don't want to attach your identity to any of those modifiers, because they are going to come and go to some degree.
Yeah, they could change. I mean, political positions change, definitions change,
right.
Your feelings change. It is, I think that's where that's why using like same-sex attracted to Christian, all that jazz, why that's the more contentious point, is because
right.
It seems like it sounds like, again, reading their vision statement and some other things, I don't think that's what they're doing, but it sounds like a capitulation to the idea that your sexuality is also intrinsic to your identity.
Right. And here's another aspect of it that I think is key. It's not just that your political or sexually orientated feelings change. It's that by attaching that word to, as a modifier to Christian, it may very well limit or excise, maybe, the power of God to actually bring about the kind of sanctification that he's going to bring about in us.
Right.
You see, so if I'm holding on to something, then making that part, at least, of my identity, I'm actually not just saying I'm going to keep that in spite of what God may be doing. I'm saying God actually has in his mind a picture for you that you don't have at all.
Yeah.
You know, any kind of picture that you add to this Christian, any kind of modifier
yeah.
that you add to this Christian keeping you from the thing God really intends for you.
What happens if in your Christian life you find out that being truly Christ-like in this particular situation or a particular issue means you actually have to go against conservatism.
Exactly.
In some way. Like, well, now what do? You call yourself
right.
a conservative Christian. You're a liberal Christian, and suddenly you find out, well, actually being Christ-like means going against liberalism. Well, now what? It's like, what do you abandon, or what do you modify, or what do you switch and change? I think that was the main issue with the more curmudgeonly crew when
uh-huh.
it came to like it, is that somehow by allowing the modifier, it was allowing that sort of like modification. Like somehow this was intrinsic, like it's okay, like you said, that it somehow creates a sort of limitation that no matter what happens, even if I agree with the Christian sexual ethic, I am same-sex attracted, and that's never going to change.
That's the assumption. That's the assumption we don't want to hold on to.
All right.
That doesn't mean that it isn't going to go.
Right.
We talked at this at length on Sunday night,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, this was at the table, too.
This whole idea of the thorn in Paul's side, you know,
yeah.
that he prayed to be taken away, and God said no 3 times, and it, I assume that never was taken away.
Yeah.
There are struggles. There are sufferings that we may go through our entire lives.
Yeah.
And I'm not taking away from that. That's what's so dangerous of saying, if you just become a Christian, everything will work out great, right?
Yeah.
You'll suddenly become a sort of East Memphis heterosexual, you know, middle class,
you know,
whatever.
You know, suburban.
Yeah.
You know,
everything is going to be
whatever.
Suddenly hunky-dory and with a white picket fence around it all. And
right.
there's a whole, you know, well, that's not life in the real world at all.
Right.
That's not the way it works at all. But But to assume one or the other, in a sense, stands in the way of what God could do. You don't want to assume that you're never going to change, that you're going to have to live with this forever. He may very well relieve you of it. On the other hand, you don't want to promise on the front end that if you just come into this faith, that suddenly everything is cleared up either. Yeah. It doesn't happen that way either.
Yeah, it's for some reason, it's reminding me of the similar idea of like the paradox of not holding a utopian political view.
Yes.
The idea that, well, if you don't believe you can actually fix the thing, then you're not going to want to do anything about it. You know, if you tell me that I don't always have to be this, if it's almost like the reverse of that. If you tell people, well, you just are same-sex attracted. That's just the way you are. Even if they agree with the Christian sexual ethic and sanctification, saying that that's just who you are and will never change may be impetus to not do anything about it. But it's like, no, that's not impetus to not do anything about it. As a matter of fact, saying like, look, maybe you'll struggle with this all your life, but by the indwelling of the Spirit and the works of sanctification in your life, maybe not. Right. Like maybe there will be an overview. Maybe, maybe not. You know, maybe not, as I say in the Bridge Shakespeare thing, by the Reduced Shakespeare Company. But is it maybe, maybe not. But like the fact that there's the there is power to resist it, and even the potential, who knows what will actually happen, but the potential to eventually one day overcome it seems impetus to like stand. Like to stand your ground and to stand in the power and the grace of God, and, or to fall on grace and like find strength in it.
Or even to recognize that your life isn't your own and that whatever he leads you to, that's the best thing possible. So it full faith seems to me to say, my life is yours now, Lord. Do with me as you please. I'm not going to follow you because you've promised that you'll take this away from me. And I'm not going to refuse to follow you because you are not going to take it away from me. Yeah. Does that make sense? I'm going to trust even the sufferings that I'm going to go through to your hands.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah. And just to reiterate something that it sounds like that's what Revoice is saying. That like, good. You know, you are not your same-sex attraction. That is not you. Okay, that's not who you really are. And these are things to mortify. There's on the website, they had something called they had a section called pre-conference where I guess it was going to be like I don't know if it's going to be an opening statement or if this is like, read this before you come to the conference.
Uh-huh.
But it was a thing called Learning to Desire Love. And it's hosted by something called Spiritual Friendship, which was started by a guy named Wesley Hill and Ron Belgau, I think it is.
Okay.
I can't remember which one of them, or both of them, I can't remember. One of them, they struggled with same-sex attraction, and they found, but they believed in the historical Christian sexual ethic, and they found that there wasn't really a lot of communal help within their church for this, so they started up something. Like, trying to argue, like, what are ways to, like, help Christians who struggle with this thing but want to adhere to sexual ethics. So they started up something called Spiritual Friendship. And in this pre-conference thing, they have like these five bullet points about this conference will provide a theological foundation to answer the main question of the conference by fleshing out what the Bible and Christian traditions have to say about, and then it lists these five things. And the middle one, the third one, it says the role of ascesis in purifying desire.
Wait a minute. Give me that word again.
A-S-C-E-S-I-S. Ascesis.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And ascesis means like very, very strict spiritual disciplines.
Okay.
Right? Like spiritual like discipline. You know, so it's like the role of strict spiritual discipline in purifying your desires. So there's this sense of like bringing your desires and your attractions under control, like bringing them under the submission of like, you know, God's order and Christ and the Lordship of Christ and stuff like that. So that seems to be like central to the whole conference, is talking about something like that.
Hmm.
So Revoice seems to be about like, you're not these desires and there's a way to address these desires that are all part of sanctification and stuff. They're talking about other things too, but it seems that that's what the point is. But like we said, the first issue seems to be they're a victim of their own marketing, all right? That they use this kind of academic-y, business-y speak that doesn't really capture on the front end, or even in the vision statement, you could like pick apart like their use of like LGBT people, or what exactly do they mean by the Christian leaders will boast about the faith of their LGBT people who are living the sacrificial obedience. So we want, do pastors want to boast about?
That's a curious use of the word boast.
But it's like, so we could pick apart their just a little bit too sloppy terminology. It reminds me, not entirely, I'll say why, how it doesn't, but it kind of reminds me, I remember when I read Velvet Elvis by Rob Bell.
Oh, yeah.
It was a similar sort of feel. He said things that I agreed with, but my response to most of what he said was like, yeah, but. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. I wanted him to make certain qualifications because it seemed like what he said was true, but the way he said it kind of left the door open for a whole bunch of nonsense to come flying. Mm-hmm. And, of course, now we've seen from Rob Bell a whole bunch of nonsense has come in.
Mm-hmm.
Since like,
so your instincts weren't wrong.
Yeah, it wasn't wrong. And here, it's not quite the same because they explicitly say, we hold to the historic Christian sexual ethic. Right?
Right.
We hold to. As a matter of fact, they're very... I said the group that sponsors this, the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender, who's sponsoring this, basically is their conference. If you go to their website, they have a statement on marriage, sexuality, and gender where they basically just flat out say something that... What they basically say is traditional Christian sexual ethic. No Orthodox, little O Orthodox Christian would disagree with it at all. Like,
right.
Yes, it's solid.
Right.
So they have that baseline that they can point to. And I don't think Bell had the baseline that he can point to. But still, it is... So it's not exactly the same, and I'm willing to, like, be give it a shot and say, like, okay, maybe this is going to be okay. But still, there is, like you, that same concern.
Yeah.
That the... kind of carelessness with the terminology is in the long run going to allow purchase for something for nonsense to come in that the, even these guys don't want, like a capitulation on the historical Christian sexual ethic,
right.
Something they don't want.
Right, right. Yeah, I have an example of that, too.
Go ahead.
Let me give you one I was thinking about. The end of one of their paragraphs toward the end of the website, the Revoice.us website,
mm-hmm.
is talking about what they believe. We believe in the Bible restricts sexual activity to the content of marriage covenant and so on. Lays out the sexual ethic that we've been talking about. And I couldn't agree with, more with that. That's really lovely. At the next paragraph, though, starts, but a historic or traditional sexual ethic is itself not automatically a Christian sexual ethic. And they make a distinction between what is traditional and what is Christian. That may be helpful. But at the very bottom of it, the sort of conclusion of it all, it says, settling for less than this results in a vision of the traditional sexual ethic whose cultural relevance might not be immediately apparent to populations of people who live at the margins of our society. Okay. But then it says, for these individuals, the ones at the margins, I guess, a culturally irrelevant sexual ethic simply doesn't feel livable. Mm-hmm. And as I was kind of with them until they said feel. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of tainted the way you're just talking about, tainted everything that they were saying above it. Because it doesn't feel a certain way, then we must stand against it.
Yeah.
I'm not so happy with that idea, right? Because the fact of the matter is martyrdom, just to be completely hyperbolic here, okay, which is the extent of Christian faithfulness, martyrdom doesn't feel good.
It certainly doesn't feel livable.
No, it doesn't feel livable. And so, because of that, there's a category for something that doesn't feel livable, but that is essentially Christian.
Yeah.
See what I mean? So I really want to be sure when we talk about things like feelings and feeling livable.
It's another one of those frustrating things because the gracious reading of it is like we have a message that is livable in a higher sense, in a more transcendent sense, and if but we have to work with how we present it. They had a paragraph, why are we called Revoice? And they said it's a musical term,
revoicing about pianos.
And revoicing it so it sounds more correct. And so we're trying to, like, not change the content, but change the way we say it. And so you can read this as, like, cultural relevance in the sense of, like, we're trying to say it in a way that gets some purchase with people.
Right.
But then they say, like, well, it doesn't feel livable. Well, it's like, okay, culturally irrelevant stuff doesn't feel livable, but what if you articulate it in a culturally relevant way and they still say it doesn't feel livable?
Right. Because it's asking them to go against their what they think is their own identity or their deepest desires or
Even if you are, I feel like the full reaching argument is something on the line of same-sex attraction is a disordered desire. And it's not necessarily, having it is not necessarily sinful. It's a product of the fall, but it's not necessarily sinful. But it's something you need to mortify. through the power of the indwelling of the Holy Spirit and a Christian community coming around you.
Right.
And also, one of the things that helps in mortifying it is recognizing it that sex and sexuality is not the main thing, that there are higher forms of intimacy and connection, your connection to God being one of the big ones, but also with other human beings, friendship is a much bigger and deeper thing, and thus being called to a life of sexual celibacy is not being called to a life of no intimacy whatsoever.
Excellently right? said. Well
like,
said.
Like, that's the argument.
Right.
I can see how you could articulate that perfectly, clearly, with no controversy, in the most winsome manner, and there'll still be people who don't feel like it's livable because for them, sex is so...
Because they
the sexual
because they haven't come
so
to that point of wrestling with that bigger picture. One of the things we said Sunday night was that I thought was useful was instead of telling people what they can't do, it's always good to try and paint a picture of what God intends and then be attracted to that. You know, there's a kind of negative approach to sin that says, you know, don't smoke, don't drink, don't go to R-rated movies,
don't
whatever,
drink, don't
kind of
chew,
pharisaical.
Don't go with girls who do.
Exactly. Don't chew tobacco, whatever. It's picking on sort of the superficial things, and many of which may not even be sinful, but mind you, they're sort of culturally understood. If that's what your picture of what sin is, then it's understandable that people would eventually argue, isn't your opposition to homosexual practice even culturally established like those other things, like chewing tobacco or something.
Yeah.
So that's a dangerous place to be. But more than that, more sort of fundamental reason why that's a bad idea is that it actually doesn't address the problem and it doesn't give you the power to be able to overcome it. Right. So even if you don't want to do certain things, you can't get out of them by saying, I'm not going to do those things. Mm-hmm. You can only substitute the right thing for it. Whatever the evil is always a perversion of a good.
Yeah.
So if you can get a hold of the good and paint a good vivid picture of that, like the beauty of a real heterosexual marriage should be, right?
Sure.
Many of which, most of our, if not all of our heterosexual marriages fall short of this too.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but if you could paint a picture of what it's supposed to be in God's mind, what you're really aiming for, then it would be so much better even to strive for that than to substitute a perversion for it, but even to entertain the desire for it.
Yeah. It's like there's two things that are coming in my brain. One is that one of the things I like about the Revoice conference so far, just like looking at it and thinking about it, just get through all the terminological stuff. They at the heart of it, they are trying to push up a positive image,
right?
To say, look at this, come be a part of this. And the positive thing they're raising, you know, we've said like modeling heterosexual marriage is like a beautiful positive. It feels like they're pushing even further and saying friendship is like this thing.
Amen.
We're going to posit as like this thing. You know, sexual experience is there and important and has a place, but there's something even grander than that that's bigger.
Yeah.
Than that. And they're holding that up and saying, like, this, to be a, you know, same-sex attracted person who submits to the Christian sexual ethic means living a sexual celibate life, but being called to the higher thing of friendship that's even more powerful and more beautiful and greater. I like that. It reminds me of, again, my bad Catholic guy, Mark Barnes, who I quote regularly. Have I mentioned him before? I may mention him almost as much as Chesterton now, but...
Who?
Mark Chesterton, or G.K. Barnes, or whatever it was. But the bad Catholic guy, he had an essay on pornography where he posited an additional way to argue against pornography for people.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to, like, you know, the moral argument and philosophical arguments, there was this argument, and I'm butchering it, but it basically was like just telling people that it's beneath you.
Right.
Like that there's so, like,
right.
So it's like, really? It's like, you're going to do that? Like, there's so much better things to do with your time and energy and your drive than just looking at stuff on a screen. That's like, he argued it so much better, but it was a similar idea of like seeing that the thing is not as important as you think it is.
Uh-huh.
And this isn't as extreme as that because sexual activity itself is not inherently sinful, but it's this idea of looking at sexual activity and saying, well, being celibate from that, okay, yeah, but it's not, that thing is not as big a deal. The activity itself is not as big a deal as you think it
mm-hmm.
is. Okay, it's just not. You know, you say, well, but isn't sex an image of the church and Christ and marriage is.
Marriage is, right.
And marriage includes sex, but so much more, and friendship is even such a bigger part of it. I mean, that, to me, that's a radically different statement, all right? And I think it's a good statement.
Yeah, we are by no means trying to say celibacy is the only way, or that that's somehow the holiness and everything.
Because that's another negation.
Exactly. Right. We're not talking about that at all. There's a great and glorious way that God built us to be sexually involved with each other. We just don't want to accept anything less than that.
Yeah. So if Revoice, if that's what they're getting at, and it sounds like they are.
Yeah, I did.
Then
I
like that.
Yeah,
but
I agree.
But then I also agree with you that the terminology they're using to try and express it, I mean, it doesn't feel like a big argument to say that it feels sloppy, but we're involved in words.
Right.
That it's not a small thing to say it sounds sloppy. It's really important that you articulate it correctly.
I think that is important. I don't think those things are a matter. You know, you hear people say, "Well, you're just dealing with semantics." As though that doesn't matter. Semantics is essential. Semantics is a very important thing.
You're just dealing with semantics. Well, so are you.
but the sentence you just used. But it's like saying, well, you just want to breathe air. Well, yeah, actually, I kind of do. Frankly, I've gotten used to it. But the words actually do matter. And that's how you make these arguments. We're called to things like, sentences like, when someone is found in sin, restore him gently and speak the truth in love.
Yeah.
Somehow there's a combination of speaking the truth and loving that we're aiming for, right? And so in every word that we use in defining these sorts of things, we want to say, how is it that I can speak the truth and also be compassionate and loving and not sort of mix the two together in an unhealthy way so that I'm either speaking the truth without love, which can be devastating to people, or loving them without the truth, which also can be, well, it can be damning, to tell you the truth. I mean, it can send you to hell. So those are extremely important things, but also not to speak truth that you think makes people feel good. Because you think that's what loving means.
Yeah.
No, loving means sacrificing yourself for their benefit. That's what love is. There's no greater love than to lay down your life for your friend. And you do that in the way you address the LGBT community like you address any other sin.
Right. And, you know, the sacrificialness that you put for that community may be telling them a tough truth. It may be recognizing when dealing with this one person, maybe it's not valuable for me to win a victory.
Amen.
You know, like at this moment, maybe it's better for me to like mourn with those who mourn, and like,
that's right.
When Christ talked to the Samaritan woman at the well, was he trying to like win an argument, or was he actually concerned about her?
That's right.
You know,
exactly right. Yeah. You know, before we quit, I know we probably have to wrap up here, but there's one other point that came up Sunday night that I kind of did. You have one more you want to talk about?
There was another point about the difference between like. Because the other issue besides terminology was the distinction between, like, is attraction itself sinful
the problem.
Or not?
Yes,
which
right.
I feel like could be a discussion unto itself.
Maybe we could bring that up.
There was a statement in the Center for Faith and Sexuality and Gender, its statement on marriage, sexuality, and gender, had something in there that people nitpicked about. But that might be a discussion unto itself.
Maybe we need to do that next time since we're running out of time. I just wanted to make sure that this got in there, because after everybody kind of broke up at the table, six or eight of us were still in the kitchen talking, as it usually happens.
Yeah.
And one of the questions that came up was the thing I think you mentioned about Paul saying that it's actually better to be single than to be married in some ways, you see. And so they were asking, you know, how is it that that can be understood? If, you know, if marriage is such a big picture of the relationship between Christ and the church, isn't that an essential aspect of what it means to be human? And aren't we, how could Paul say that it would be better somehow to be single? You know, is he just sort of throwing a bone to the single people and say, you know, you guys are really good too? Or something? No, it's not that way at all. And here's what occurred to me as we talked about it, and then we can close up. We're told that marriage between a husband and a wife in this world is only for this world. That is, when we depart this world, one of the things is if your spouse dies, then you're released from your oath to that person and you can remarry, right? Okay, well, in heaven, there won't be any marriage, we're told. Right. Why is that? because the original is the relationship between Christ and the church. And the imitation of it in this time-bound fallen world is this relationship between husband and wife.
Right.
So when the truth comes, when the bridegroom himself comes, then he outshines everything else. And
right.
all of those secondary things, in a sense, collapse into the main thing that it was an imitation of to begin with. See? So could it be that the kind of attitude towards singleness that Paul is describing is the, in a sense, starting that eternal relationship now.
Yeah.
See? So yeah. that the nun, say, is married to Jesus,
yeah.
not married to another person. She's married to Jesus. And she's experiencing something of that, what she's going to have eternally right now, and can
yeah.
exhibit that, in a sense, in the world in a way, too.
Yeah. My grandmother, who she passed away, like, last year. But when her husband died, and he died, I mean, relatively youngish. Like, I think he was, like, maybe in his, like, early 60s or something like that. He had, like, health complications.
Oh, yeah.
And he died. So she was, like, a widow in, like, her mid to late 50s. And so she stayed, and she never remarried.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in, like, the later years of her life, she told me that she just decided to treat, you know, God in, like, her husband, basically.
Beautiful.
That God was the one who was going to take care of her and look after her and provide her emotional needs and stuff like that. It was a very similar kind of thing.
Wow, that's beautiful.
And
that makes sense. That makes sense.
So, recommendations?
Yeah. I think since we're talking about this,
for critical engagement purposes, we both recommend that our listeners go check out the Revoice website.
That's right.
Revoice.us, and look at it yourself. Check out the mission statement. Check out the workshop. Check out especially their vision statement, their pre-conference thing, and also the things at the bottom. What does Revoice think about human sexuality? So read this stuff for yourself. And
I'd be interested to have people read, too, the blurbs that they give for the workshops.
Yes.
Some of them are really interesting. And frankly, I want to say on record, I would really like to go to this conference.
Yeah,
I think
me too.
I would benefit from it greatly.
Yeah, me too.
I think there'd be a lot to learn. I'd like to recommend, since we're talking about the homosexual question, I'd like to recommend a book that I've been teaching with my fellows students, by Kevin DeYoung, called What Does the Bible Really Teach About Homosexuality?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very good, even-handed and loving take on the questions. He goes through and deals with a lot of the nitpicky issues that questions that people have about how it is that the Leviticus passages mean, and how is it that, you know, we take certain parts of Leviticus very seriously and other parts not, that kind of thing today, the law, you know, and New Testament references too. So Kevin DeYoung, What Does the Bible Really Teach About Homosexuality?
Excellent. My recommendation is a book I haven't read yet, but I plan to read, and I'm recommending it because the author is someone, she came through town, actually, and she's famous, Rosaria Butterfield.
Rosaria, okay.
Yeah, Rosaria Butterfield.
Yes, I've read her story. It's amazing.
Yeah, she has a book, she had a book about the thoughts of an unlikely convert, but she has another one called Openness Unhindered, Further Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert on Sexual Identity and Union with Christ.
Excellent.
If you don't know who Rosaria Butterfield is, she's one of those people, like Hodges mentioned, who had same-sex attraction and did not pray the gay away.
Right.
But believed and bought into the Christian sexual ethic and has been trying to faithfully live it. And she's married and I think has kids. I think her story, she was like a, you know, PhD liberal gender studies professor who was lesbian.
That's right. And had her lesbian partner.
And now she's married to a husband and is a Christian, and people are like, why?
Yeah.
And so she talks about it. But she has a book called Openness Unhindered. If you haven't read anything by her, read stuff by her. It's interesting. It'll be interesting stuff. That's all we got for today. Thank you for joining us. This has been From the Center, and we'll catch you next time.
Very good.